I will call this meeting of the House Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee to order. First order of business here is approval of the meeting minutes from April 9th. Representative Norris, since you made eye contact with me, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Norris moves approval of the meeting minutes from April 9th. Is there any discussion to that motion? Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't think the minutes really reflect what a fun hearing we had last time on regenerative farming, but I just wanted to make note that there's an omission.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. We will note for the record the joviality that occurred as a result of that discussion. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of adopting the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. Motion prevails. We have meeting minutes from April 9th. Relatively brief agenda today. I say that as I knock on wood, but we will start with House File 4479, Representative Frederick. And we will, members, for your knowledge, we will be laying all of these bills over today. Representative Frederick, when you are settled in, if you want to go ahead and introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. House File 4479 is a bill that would put into state law that our institutions that we help fund as a legislature are open for our use should we look to host a town hall. Now, it's not just for the legislature. It would be for city council members, county commissioners, anyone who is in elected office who is looking to have a conversation with their constituents. I think most universities in this case would be very open and welcoming to anybody that is looking to host an event in their space, but this would just say that they can't put up any barriers should someone want to host a town hall, such as charging for a fee or charging for parking or anything like that. So there were some I would say guardrails put in place too that really is gearing this towards having conversations between community members and whoever the elected person is, again, whether that's city council, county commissioner, legislature, someone in the executive branch too. And this is, and just to be very, very clear, it's official side only. This is not pertaining to campaign or anything in that area. And that's it. And then I also have a testifier, I believe is on Zoom.
Yes, thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Representative Frederick. We have Jim Dimmick from Minnesota State University, Mankato. Mr. Dimmick, if you could identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Certainly. My name is Jim Dimmick. I'm a professor of communication and media at Minnesota State University, Mankato, where I teach courses in public speaking, argumentation, advocacy, and public discourse.
Proceed.
Let me really thank Representative Frederick for the opportunity to come and speak today. He had mentioned this legislation to me in passing several weeks ago, and I am a self-confessed town hall geek. I love town halls. I go to town halls, and I've even been able to engage in some research and studies. And I could make this committee meeting run much, much longer by telling you all about the history of town halls and the role they play in the United States. But in the interest of time, and in the interest of really pushing town halls as something that are, I think, an incredibly important bottom-up approach to democracy, one that transcends political allegiance, I really like to encourage the passage of this law, in part because I think one of the things that you'll do is establish kind of in law, maybe even for the first time, like what a town hall really actually is. There's no, to my knowledge, legal definition. There's no, this is a clearly, absolutely what a town hall is and must be. But to get what we want and to get, I think, what, you know, Representative Frederick is really hoping to get, which is honest, open dialogue between policymakers and the constituencies that they represent, in my opinion, there really does need to be at least three things present that define a town hall and make it what it is. First and foremost, it has to be public and it has to be open. If there's not space for not just two different sides, but all of the different sides and perspectives to come together in a room, then what you have is just a campaign speech. You have a rally. You don't have a town hall. Openness and publicity, the spaces in which everyone should feel like they can come, and to the greatest degree possible, there's got to be some constraint, but to the greatest degree possible, people can speak and be heard by the people who are really, in very real ways, impacting the way that they will live their lives. The second thing I think you really need to have in order for a town hall to be a town hall is there does need to be some neutral moderator, someone who filters questions, sort of stands between the audience and those people who are opening themselves up to that kind of question. Without that, I think that what you have is a free-for-all, or worse, what you have is a stilted kind of performance in which some questions are going to be excluded and others are going to be highlighted. So a neutral moderator is especially important. And last but not least, the third thing I think you need to have in order to really call it a town hall is that a town hall is not a speech. A town hall is not a passive audience sitting back and listening to what some elected official wants to tell us. A town hall is a dialogue, or even better put, a multi-log in which people are having a conversation back and forth with one another about the issues that impact their lives. And I think that Representative Frederick's legislation really does stress the importance of all three of these values. Our colleges and our universities should be places that encourage the widest possible range of dialogue. There's absolutely nothing about a town hall that in any way is inconsistent with the values that our college and university here at Minnesota State Mankato express in our own free speech policies and in our own statements about what we believe and value. These should be centers not just of learning, but of public conversations about the issues that matter most. I know, I actually just left a meeting with our president, President Inch, and he had stressed to me that he's like, the fee that we asked to charge is relatively small, and it's really not a very large fee. It shouldn't be that much of an inconvenience. And he really encouraged that we use student-sponsored organizations like the College Democrats or the Campus Republicans to sponsor these, and that would eliminate the need for a charge. But unfortunately, in my opinion, what that does is that then limits us to an event sponsored by one political party rather than sponsored by the university as a whole. That really conflicts with that sense of openness and that sense of neutrality and moderatedness that I think are really very important to getting the most out of our town halls. And so I would really urge you to move forward on this legislation. I think it has a potential to have a really strong impact on not just our political processes, but on the way in which our communities perceive and understand the campuses and universities as spaces where everyone can come to learn and participate and engage.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Dimmock. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on House File 4479? Seeing no one, we will turn to member discussion. Representative Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Frederick, curious, have you used the campus before for your town halls and suddenly now they're gonna be charging? Is that kind of one of the things that motivated this legislation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I would say is that my town halls in the past have been at my city council, and after the last one that we had, I was told that I wasn't welcome back anymore, and I was like, what? And they were like, there's so many people here, we're breaking the fire code. I was like, oh. So I started pursuing other avenues and looking what the other options were, and I think of our public universities as community centers, as hubs within the communities that they are a part of. And it made sense to me that would be a natural place for us to be able to host town halls. When I think of our higher ed system just as a whole, I think of like all of the conversations that I had on so many different topics when I went to school at MSU. And it felt like a natural space. I did find that they did have the fee. And that was one of the things that I was concerned about. And to the point that Mr. Dimmick made about if it's a student-sponsored thing, then it turns it could be perceived bias. Whether that's the student organization putting that bias in or whether that's the elected person may not be there, but then the community as a whole could view it through that lens, and that's what I was trying to avoid with this, that if we remove the requirement for it to be a student-sponsored activity, then you remove any perceived bias that might be there. And I do know that there are out of the other state schools that I have been able to talk to, that they wouldn't have a fee. So it's not all universities within our state system are the same either.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so can I ask what the fee was, what the fee is that they charge?
Sorry, Representative Frederick.
I don't recall what that exact number was, and I don't want to give you the wrong number off the top of my head.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I can't imagine that it's extremely high, something that your campaign funds wouldn't cover. But I do want to just point out something that you said, that we as legislators help fund these institutions. And that is true only to the extent that we are all individual taxpayers. The taxpayers fund these institutions. The taxpayers fund our salaries. So if that institution wants to charge us $100 or $200 or $500 to use that facility, I can either pay that amount or I can find a different venue. I don't see this as being, a necessary thing to do. That's my comments. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we'll get to you in a moment, Chair Rowland. I think Mr. Dimmick may have had something to add on that question.
I was going to simply, based on my conversations with President Inch this morning, the fee is a couple hundred dollars, $100 to $200.
Thank you, Mr. Dimmick. Chair Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Frederick. So I have concerns about this. I wondered, has OHE or MnState or the U weighed in on this bill?
Representative Frederick, or?
They're welcome to. I mean, I've had.
I think I see. Maybe I don't. Maybe I do see Mr. Oman gearing up to inform us all.
I have had conversations with Mr. Chair, just for the record.
Mr. Oman, when you're settled, please introduce yourself for the record and tell us what you know.
Chair Coulter, members of the committee, yes, Representative Frederick reached out to me a ways back about, you know, his concern and bringing this bill forward. Just to the dollar amount, and I did a little bit of look, and it depends what kind of room you're looking at. My understanding is that Mankato discounts their rate by 50% for these types of events. So it's, I think it's like $125 for a smaller room. It sounds like Mr. Frederick has some pretty sizable crowd, so it'd probably be more if the auditorium. What I am told from the campus is the reason they do the fee is they want to just cover their costs. This isn't new to us at Minnesota State. Obviously, with 54 campuses across Minnesota, we have significant interaction with local legislators, and we probably host a handful of these types of events throughout the year, and we appreciate doing that. But having said that, our fee structure on something like this is determined at the campus level and not at the system level driven down. And what I've done in the past, because many times legislators would reach out to me about doing events, and I always set them up with the local student government association, so it's not a partisan thing with college Democrats or college Republicans. It's more the student government, and you know, and by doing that way, costs are negated. But having, and in hindsight, there's a big event in St. Cloud. It's called Donuts with Dan, and those events are so big, they're like a Lady Gaga concert. And I think we should have maybe charged him a little bit more. So there'll be an invoice coming to Chair Wolgamott later after the session is over, of course. But, you know, Representative Frederick is a huge supporter of Minnesota State Mankato and of Minnesota State. So hopefully we can get to a better place. But that's kind of the way our system is at right now.
Thank you for that. Thank you, Mr. Oman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess I don't have a question. I have some thoughts. And my when I first heard about this, it just seems like we want special treatment because we're legislators and we should get a break. And we have campaign funds to pay expenses like this. And we should not be micromanaging in statute, in my opinion, to tell all of the campuses how they should treat these events. They already have figured out we shouldn't get priority over other groups that might want to come on campus. I just, if people want to have their events at a college, I think they should pay the rate because that covers the cost for janitorial and for security and whatever. And certainly they shouldn't be giving free parking. I was stunned to have the parking thing. That parking cost and the cost of having these rooms is a cost to that college. And for us to expect them to do something for free for legislators and for us to put that in statute, I find offensive, honestly. And I think we should just continue as it's always been. If someone wants to have an event at a local college, they call and see if there's a room available and they pay the fee and their citizens who choose to come may have to pay for parking. But I think we should be treated just like any other group that wants to have an event on campus. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. Representative Schwartz.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Fredericks, on line 1.22, it says the bill says it would provide an available and appropriate space based on a reasonable estimate of attendance. Who decides what is reasonable?
Representative Frederick.
That would be a conversation between the individual, again, whether this is a legislator, a city council member, they would be a conversation between the person, the elected official, and the university. I would imagine that whoever the person is going to have an idea of what size of room that they would need, and then they could work in partnership with the university to determine what the appropriate size would be.
Okay.
Representative Schwartz.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Also, what happens if there's a dispute as far as size of the room that you'd be wanting to get?
Representative Frederick.
Dispute by implying that one person wants a bigger room.
Yeah, say you wanted a bigger room and the school said we only have this smaller one available to you. How would that dispute be?
So what I would say is that on the second page of the bill, it outlines that if there is not a bigger, if the person is looking to host a town hall and they have an expectation that there's going to be 100 people or 300 people, whatever the number is, and the university does not have a larger space available on the day that person is looking for, they don't get it. That's spelled out in the bill too, someone that's seeking to host a town hall at a university doesn't get to like boot somebody out of a space. Like it is a good faith effort needs to be put in by anybody that's looking to host the town hall to work in partnership with the university to find the space that best fits the needed size. So if someone is expecting 500 people, I don't know, pick a number. And the space that would be accommodate that isn't available on the specific day because it's already been booked, well, then that elected official doesn't get to just claim that space. They would have to pivot. They would either have to look at a different venue or they'd have to pick a different day that maybe that larger space is available. They don't just automatically get the room.
Representative Schwartz?
So you're saying that the school would decide, would make the final decision as far as the venue?
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I would say
size
is
of the venue. Sorry.
What?
So you're saying sorry.
Why don't you just repeat your question?
Okay. Yeah. So you're saying that the school would ultimately make the final decision as far as the size of the room that you're going to be renting or getting for hosting the event.
Representative Frederick.
What I've said is that it is a partnership in the conversation between the two. I don't think the school would necessarily choose what events like people are having in their specific room, so it's not like the school itself would choose in that way. So I guess I'm not completely tracking like where you're going with that, because if a room is already booked and you need a bigger room because you're expecting a larger crowd, yeah, and that room's not available, then if you want to phrase that the school is his ultimate say on that, then I guess.
Okay.
But that's not necessarily the school's choice either. So a different group had already like reserved the room or requested the space. So again, it goes back to having a partnership in the conversation about what the needs are and then finding the space that would accommodate the needs and then finding a day that would that space is available.
Representative Schwartz, anything further?
Yeah. Closing comment. I believe our public colleges and universities should remain focused on education, not serving as venues for our political events.
Thank you. Yeah. Representative Schwartz, Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Frederick, what happens if there's a big security concern or, as we've seen a lot of protests lately, what if there's a security contingent that needs to keep this safe? Who's going to pay for that?
Representative Frederick.
That is not spelled out in the bill. So it would not be something that would be the requirement of the university to hold. I do know that there is a new funding available for legislators, I believe that was after the events of this last year. But if you're talking about like city council, county commissioner, they would have to determine what they feel would be appropriate or not, and then figure out how to fund it from there. That it is not spelled out in this bill.
Representative Vani.
Thank you, Chair. And you know, that part of the bill is appealing to me from the standpoint that at least some of these fees would be based and they'd be agnostic. So I appreciate that. But if, you know, we're going to start having other fees that we're going to tack on and that'll be at the discretion of the school, then it puts us right back in the position that we're at. As we found out today in judiciary, you can't turn a light on at a state institution without somebody wanting a fiscal note filed, even if they're paying that person, whether they turn a light on or not. But I think, like I said, I appreciate the bill the way it's, with the idea of it that there's fair access and that it's not partisan, but I think you're going to need to do a lot more to make this fair for all. Just my thought. Thank you.
Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Frederick, I was kind of wondering on line 2.10, it says may direct their request to the nearest public post-secondary institution if elected official does not have a public post-secondary institution within their jurisdiction. I'm just kind of wondering what that kind of shifts the burden, doesn't it, in terms of that event going into a different school. Like, for instance, if I didn't have necessarily a college in my area, I'd have to either run to Owatonna, run to Northfield, run over to Red Wing, have to run all the way over into Mankato in order to be able to hold an event. Aren't you concerned it's you're having representatives going outside of their district speaking to groups, particularly that aren't necessarily being represented by them?
Representative Frederick.
Thank you for that. So when this bill was getting drafted, one of the concerns that Nonpartisan brought up was what if there isn't a school in someone's district? And that was a recommendation that we can say then that for like legislators, right, because city council, I mean, I guess we can frame it under legislators. If legislators don't have a public university, to the example that you just said, I wanted to make sure that then you would have a space to go if you chose. Now, you don't have to, right? There's nothing that requires you to have a town hall. And so it could be an issue. There's nothing that requires, in this bill, there's nothing that requires you, should you choose to have a town hall, have it at the university. You could choose to have it at a park or wherever. It would be an option for you to choose from if that is something that you wanted to pursue. So I wanted to make sure through the lens of anybody in the legislature or anywhere else, that if they don't have a public institution like this in their district, that they still could have some of those community conversations if they wanted to. And it would be an option that would be available to you or anyone else.
Representative Allen.
And I'm glad you brought that up and mentioned that. Like you said, you could host it in the park. You have right down the road from Mankato State or Minnesota State, you have the Blue Earth County Government Center is located. They have their library center, their library is located there. Plenty of venues that you can get into very easily. And much to your testifier's comments, I mean, he even said that there's even the possibility of you being able to go through a student organization and have them reserve the room for you. I have grave concerns about this, alluding back to a lot of the issues that have been pointed in terms of security cleanup and limited classroom space. One of the things I was surprised to hear when you start talking to universities is one of those things you never see as a student is the brokering it takes behind the scenes in order to be able to line up rooms, in order to be able to have classes. I didn't realize how much of that actually happened where, as a student, you don't see that. I'm appreciative to our universities for what they do, appreciative for everything that they put into it, and seeing from what I've seen on the bonding side, they're very willing to help out where they can. But I think there's plenty of options out there, and I just don't see a way forward with this bill. But thank you for bringing it forward.
Representative Cleborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll take the conversation in a little different direction. I do think that we have to consider the cost for janitorial, just cleanup after, whatever that might be. But I would say that would be at maybe that cost or fee would be based on a percentage of whatever it costs to actually clean up the room after. But I think there's some real positives about this bill because as representatives, if we do our job well, it's not about us. It's about the community. And there are topics that come before our communities that are of great importance. Whether it's for my community right now, it's whether we're gonna lose our transit or not, right? And that might be a time when, while I don't have a post-secondary institution in my district, it might be a time where I would need a space that is much larger than, let's say, my city council chambers where I do it. I do think the number of buildings that we have in a community, not all of those buildings are readily accessible, nor are all of those buildings comfortable for some people to be in that space for whatever reason. Most of our post-secondary institutions are ADA accessible, they're culturally appropriate, and they work very well for most everyone to feel comfortable in that space. So I think that the importance of that should not be overlooked, and I think that's an important part of your bill. I also think that it's important to remember that the buildings belong to the community. They don't just belong for student use or for professor use. They belong to everybody, as was stated, they're taxpayer funded. So I think the conversation needs to be switched from what is the benefit to the legislator to what is the benefit to the community. So in that regard, I think this is an excellent bill. However, I would say, depending on how many electeds you had in a community, right? It could be a lot of meetings. So I would say that if you had multiple people, you would get multiple meetings. If you have one person, you get one meeting, right? Or something like that, so that it doesn't get to be excessive. But I do think the costs of the institution for that janitorial cleanup, that really should be covered. But the other thing that this bill does, which I think is very important, is it reminds people that we have public institutions in their community that are available for use for different things. And the institutions would not be surprised to hear me say, there are more things that our institutions can be used for in addition to teaching students, mm-hmm. right? So this might open up a conversation of, could we be holding farmers markets at there? Should we be doing more health clinics there? Should we be doing isolation prevention at our state institutions? There's so many community events that we can use our institutions for in addition to teaching students. And democracy is about public dialogue. And there is no better place to do public dialogue than in a public building. So thank you for bringing the bill forward. And I know today is just informational. So.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing the bill. I think the conversation did get a little bit derailed. And I, you know, and I originally, when I saw this, I kind of had that reaction too, that, oh, this is kind of, you know, I don't like bills that look to me like a legislator's getting a special privilege, right? But I think on further reflection, and especially we heard from Professor Dimmock, and I think what this is really about is the value of town halls and the fact that there is a public interest in holding them. And maybe this is really kind of getting at whether that is really part of the educational mission of our institutions. So I really, even though there was a question about how you came up with the bill and you explained it, we all, many of us come up with bills because of some particular experience we had that doesn't make the bill about us or about our need to change something for ourselves. And I don't think that's what's going on here. So the real question for me, I guess, on this is just that, you know, whether any of the schools are denying the use of their facility. I think that would be a problem if they were saying, no, the public, you may not hold a public event here, period. That would, to me, be a problem. I'm not aware that that's happening. Or if the fees were somehow discriminatory, kind of doing the same thing. So I think there's a real value here. Maybe there needs to be a cap on fees that limits it to cover costs of the institution. That might be janitorial. It might be something else. They may have to, I know in my local community college, you know, they have to have extra people there to make sure it gets closed up and somebody to manage a sound system. And so I don't know how they calibrate the costs, but it would make sense to say that they shouldn't charge more than they actually have to pay or the actual cost of the service so that it isn't sort of discriminating against the public use of that. And I'm not aware that anybody is doing that. So maybe some kind of a cap on fees. And then I really don't think that, and this is of course not just about legislators by its terms of the bill, it's about public officials. That's important. This isn't a self-interest bill. It's really about the public interest. So I think that's important that, you know, public officials shouldn't get special treatment, certainly, but also that there is really a public interest in having, you know, that our institutions are serving as well. And so I think it's very good to bring the bill, and thank you, and just to have the conversation to kind of open that up and consider it. If the bill would go forward, I also would like to see the institutions be able to charge just enough to cover their costs. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative, do you have a response to that or no? You don't have to. Okay. Just you looked like you had something to say. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. I like this because I think it's important to recognize that a lot of people have never even been to a college campus. And there's a direct correlation between visiting a college campus and that person's more, likelihood is increased to go to college. And we all know that when we have more folks who go to college or trade school and pursue those kinds of employment skills, that everybody in society does better. Our country does better, our economy does better, so on and so forth. So I wanted to just highlight that this also brings people to campus who may not otherwise ever visit. And there's a whole lot of good things that can come out. I think exposure matters. When you bring your kids with you to a town hall, potentially at a university, they may remember that. I know I, even as an adult, remembered my first time setting foot on St. Kate's campus for school and how beautiful it was and the flowers and all of that. And my kids have never forgot that. And so I think that, for me, is an important reminder that our kids are watching, and where we bring them and what we expose them to in childhood can make a huge difference in their lives. Civic engagement used to be nonpartisan, so I'm sad to hear some of the comments. I think it is important that we value that, embrace that, embody that and act like that is something we should continue to do. We all know that I do a lot of work with youth in civic engagement, and we can see that even just a two-day visit field trip to the Capitol for the model legislature allows them to shift their perspectives about what their future of civic engagement looks like, their future college plans, the issues they're interested in. And it just really helps to ensure that we have a more educated group of folks coming up to that voting age really soon. So I just wanted to make sure we remember how important civic engagement is and that we not kind of belittle or discredit that in any way by forgetting to talk about it, that we need people to participate in politics, and I frankly think we could use some more. So thanks.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Representative Knorr.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, Representative Frederick. If a student initiates the town hall hearing, so that will be at no cost. Is that correct?
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If a student group initiates the town hall at what we heard from Minnesota State Mankato, that they would waive that fee in Mankato. Now, there some of the challenges with that is that if it's a that could publicly it could be perceived as there's bias there, is that this organization is sponsoring this candidate, so therefore there's bias. And so saying disconnecting those two things was my desire to try to address some of the perceived bias anyways, even if there may not be any. And to what we heard also is that each university across the state can also have their own policy and how that happens, and so there's not uniformity, and so then this bill would seek uniformity across the state.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that's one of the reasons why we should have this bill, because people are going to use the loophole to go through the student body to have the meetings, because I get invited many meetings at the U of M because I'm in a college area. So that means every event that I'm going to, having a town hall at the University of Minnesota that the students initiated, that's the other loophole that people will tend to be using more frequently by calling the student body or groups to actually reserve a room, and then we can continue to bring the public and everyone into the campus area. So having more straightforward process of what to do for those elected officials cuts through some of the red tape and make sure that we follow the rules that exist for elected officials. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Knorr. I am not seeing any other folks, so I will just say that I think this is a really good bill. I think it's a really good concept. One question I would just raise specifically around parking fees is that parking is often what we would call in the city of Blooming an enterprise fund, meaning that the fees pay for the parking itself. And so I think that is just, it's those kinds of things that I think we also need to evaluate. But really as somebody who's been doing, I call them community conversations since I was on the city council and had only two people show up to one. It was a very intimate conversation. I know the value of that. And, you know, we spent a lot of time today talking about legislators doing these events, but I'm thinking of the value that our local officials could get out of going to college campuses and meeting with folks there and meeting with students there. Students are residents of cities and counties. And, you know, when there's traffic engineering and other things that happen around our college campuses, those things impact students. So I think there is a lot of potential value here for that. So I think there is something I maybe even want to consider expanding to include non-elected officials. You know, if the community development director wants to talk about affordable housing just off of campus at Minnesota State Mankato, that might be a conversation that folks on campus would be interested in. So I think we will turn things over to Chair Wolgamott, and then Representative Frederick, you can close this out.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for the robust discussion on this. I wanted to bring this bill forward because and give it a hearing because I really appreciate what Representative Frederick has been going through and his willingness to step up and do town halls And I've had such incredible success. As Mr. Oman mentioned, I've been very well accommodated by St. Cloud State and St. Cloud Technical Community College and had some really incredible conversations and meetings, my donuts with Dan. Kind of a neat fact, another bill that's on the agenda today is being brought forward by a constituent of mine who's here and talked to me about the subject matter of the bill at a Donuts with Dan event. So it's kind of come full circle here, but I really want to thank you, Representative Frederick, for bringing this forward, for your commitment to accessibility and transparency and accountability in your role as a legislator. I'd like to thank all the campuses at Minn State for their willingness to be a part of this conversation and make sure we can strike that balance of figuring out, you know, what's a responsible way to do this while also tapping into all of the various benefits to our students, to our communities, when we can have those conversations with our elected officials, which in this day of keyboard warriors and all the divisiveness on social media, when we can come together, share the same space, look each other eye to eye, have those conversations, that's what is the key linchpin to our successful democracy. So again, thank you for bringing this bill forward, and thank you to the members for the good conversation today.
Thank you, Chair Wilmot. Representative Frederick, any final thoughts?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say that this is a work in progress. If people want to talk more about the parking piece of it, I'm more than happy to talk about it. I will say that one of the concerns was the city, maybe, that you're paying parking into, this would not apply to that. In what I was envisioning, if it was like a campus lot, that you just go in, but you'd have to pay to just park on that lot, was I didn't want parking to be a barrier from somebody that wanted to participate. That was the goal behind it. If there's a better way to do that, consider me open ears for whatever that is, whatever that looks like. But again, it's about accessibility, right? And that parking is a piece of accessibility, to the point of where it's taxpayer funded, and that's true. I mean, it's a public building. These are public officials that we are talking about, and the whole goal of this is for the community to be able to have conversations with their elected officials. I would assume that I'm not alone in this, in that we, as legislators here just in this body, we talk with constituent groups that are just itching to be heard. We talk with people that don't feel like that they're being heard in whatever it is that they may be advocating for. And to the point that Professor Dimmick brought up about his 3 points of what makes a good town hall, the number three thing that he listed, it's not a speech, right? It's a conversation. And that is the goal of this bill, is to help conversations happen between the average everyday citizen and the elected officials that represent them at whatever level it may be. So I think those conversations are incredibly important and impactful, and this is just one piece that my goal is to help further those conversations in the future. So thank you to the committee for hearing the bill.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. And with that, House File, I already forgot the number. 4479 is laid over. Thank you. We will move on to Representative Hansen. Has two bills before us today. We will start with House File 4368. All right, Representative Hansen. All right, Representative Hansen, whenever you're ready, proceed.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Committee. We're starting with House File 4368, correct, Chair?
Correct.
Thank you, Chair. Members, last year I presented House File 1751 to you. That was to open the discussion about ensuring contingent faculty have access to insurance on a more reasonable credit structure than what's currently in place. This committee agreed that this was an issue that we should talk about and that we needed to address, but the fiscal note was $89 million. So as such, I have pivoted, and this is House File 4368 that's before you now, to convene a working group to deliver a report back to our committee by December 15th of 2027 to give us some idea of how we could, if at all, move ahead with addressing this issue. So as a reminder for those who need it, the stories that we heard about adjunct faculty losing their benefits and suffering real life consequences were heartbreaking. Adjuncts can only work up to 12 credits, and they need 12 credits to maintain health insurance coverage. Credits can fall due to enrollment, which is really out of the control of the instructor. And this happens at 70% of institutions nationally. The goal here is to be sure that there is adequate, consistent insurance coverage for instructors who teach on an adjunct or contingent faculty status. Adjunct faculty do not have contracts that protect ongoing employment from semester to semester, but most have taught within our system for many decades. Overall, there are over 3,000 adjunct faculty at Minnesota's largest system of higher education, and nationally, about 70 to 75% of instructors are on a non-tenure track, despite AAUP recommending the opposite, with just 25 or a quarter to a third being on that adjunct status. Adjuncts with master's degrees can't even count on being paid higher compared to someone with an adjunct with a bachelor's degree. The February 2026 report from College and University Professional Association for Human Resources, or CUPA HR, they recently did a report on adjuncts in higher ed, and they concluded in their recommendations that, among other things, we recognize the value that adjuncts bring to the institutions, and it's my opinion that making sure that they have access to consistent health insurance while they're making sure they're educating folks who are looking to gain more skills is a really great way for our body to recognize that. And with that, Chair, I will turn it over to my testifier. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. I see we have two testifiers here. At least one is at the table right now. If you could introduce yourself for the record, and you can proceed.
Thanks. Yeah, my name is Faith Erickson. I teach at St. Cloud State and St. Cloud Community College. And thank you, Chair Robbins and Chair Wogelmont and Vice Chair Schwartz and Coulter and the members of the committee. As I said, my name is Faith Erickson, and I teach English at St. Cloud Technical and Community College and St. Cloud State University. And I've been contingent faculty, which is adjunct or temporary faculty, for 17 years. There are about 7,500 faculty in the Minnesota state system, and about 3,700 of them are contingent faculty. That's nearly half. And their ability to maintain insurance is haphazard, riddled with obstacles, and quite frankly, dangerous. I entered this work as an advocate after about 12 years of growing frustration, depletion, and anxiety about what would come from one semester to the next. A well-meaning colleague of mine told me that if I wanted to do anything about it, I should come to St. Paul and get something done. She didn't think I would actually do something about it, but here I am. And so this is what I want to tell you. For contingent faculty, there's about 2 months of some semblance of security before you're back to worrying about your next schedule, and that's not just your pay, that's retirement, insurance, your ability to pay student loans, your family. That kind of uncertainty might make sense earlier in your career, but that's not the contingent faculty of today. These are career educators with terminal degrees, and they've been loyal to our system for decades. I only have the numbers for MSCF, which is the two-year community college system, but 15% have taught in our system for over 20 years, 40% for more than 10 years, 50% for 7 years or more, and that's not off and on, 70% return year after year, and yet we're told that the system can't provide them stability. So clearly, if we have those numbers, they're providing them the stability. It already depends on their consistency, but it doesn't return that stability back to them. And one of the biggest failures of the stability is the lack of their insurance. In both MSDF and IFO contracts, contingent faculty must meet a credit threshold to get insurance access to qualify. But because this cost sit at the campus level, there's an incentive to keep contingent faculty below the credit threshold for insurance. At Metro State, one instructor was kept at 11.99, that's 0.10 below the credit threshold for insurance. There's not such a thing as 0.999 credit, so that's 12 minutes of class time that was given to another instructor just to prevent benefits. And that's not isolated. There's currently a policy being discussed to keep faculty at a college to under 15 credits per year, which would be, at this college, a cost-saving measure to keep everyone out of insurance for contingent faculty. But this is what this looks like in practice. I just want to give some stories now. In some of the states, there's one or two technical faculty that are full-time and the rest are contingent. And one of them, the only one who knew, who had the credentials to keep the program running, was about to quit because he had $30,000 health bill, and he didn't have the insurance. So luckily his fellows came together to help him stay. A new father told me his course was dropped days before the semester started. His section filled, but a full-time instructor's didn't. So I just want you to think about that, that a contingent faculty's section filled, a full-time instructor's didn't. So then a full-time instructor took that class because they need their courses filled. But that meant that he didn't get the insurance that he needed because his credit threshold went down. His premium went from $39 a month to $416 a month on top of the lower salary. So he kept cold calling different colleges to try to get the class he needed to bump up so he had the insurance and didn't have to pay that huge amount of premium, but it was days before the semester started that his class was dropped, and so he couldn't get another class. He said he felt like a failure to his family. Another faculty told me her story through tears. She's a single parent with three adopted children, all with mental health challenges due to prenatal exposure, early trauma. She had finally gotten approval to get her 9-year-old in a residential treatment center. We know that it's hard to get insurance for mental health issues anyway. And then because her insurance dropped, because one of her classes was taken away, he was forced to come home in the middle. She said, I couldn't stop sobbing and shaking as I thought about my child coming home without the help he needed. I live in constant fear of losing access to the support my kids need. That fear never leaves. And then, I'm sure I've told this story again, but it's worth telling. Early in my teaching career, around 2010, I was asked to take an online class middle of the semester, and I would have done anything, as many contingent faculty would have. And I heard that the reason was because a contingent faculty had learned that she had cancer, and she just wanted to make sure that she taught long enough so that she had the insurance benefits so that her kids wouldn't have to end up paying the cost. And I remember thinking that as much as I love teaching, I did not want to spend my final days teaching an online course so that my kids didn't have to pay the insurance benefits. But I also did not want to end up passing those costs of my final days to my kids. And I wish that that were a 2010 problem. But recently a faculty told me that she lost a colleague to cancer and that it was her goal in her last months to have 6 credits so that she could keep her insurance. And she taught up until December of 2024, and she died in January 15th, 2025. And then lastly, a contingent colleague of mine said that he felt like something was wrong, but he didn't go to the doctor, which is a common thing. And his wife made him, and it saved his life. But it was luck. It was pure luck. So this isn't rare. Faculty delay care. They take on impossible schedules, they make major life decisions just to keep insurance, and sometimes they just get lucky. And the impact on students is real when their instructors are exhausted, stressed, afraid of losing healthcare. They have been a stable force in the system for years, just without that stability in return. Insurance instability robs our system of fully present, healthy teachers. And if we're gonna rely on contingent faculty, we can't do it by shifting costs onto their back and their lives. This bill gives us a chance to sit together and talk about the obstacles that we face and grapple with the realities of this issue on both sides. Thank you for your time, and I welcome your question.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson. I see we have one other testifier signed up, Eric Davis. If you could identify yourself. Thank you. You could identify yourself for the record, and you can proceed.
Thank you, Chair Coulter, members of the committee. I'm Eric Davis. I serve as the Vice Chancellor for Human Resources at Minnesota State Colleges and Universities System. Thank you. I wanted to share this perspective with the committee. Employer-sponsored health insurance and its eligibility thresholds are mandatory subjects of collective bargaining for both employers and unionized employees, including the Minnesota State faculty. The state's bargaining authority over health insurance is placed with the Minnesota Management and Budget Agency, CGIP for short, State Employee Group Insurance Plan. And under this section, or the CGIP MMB, they govern the state employee benefits, and they would continue to be the bargaining of the eligibility thresholds and the cost share for it would continue to be the responsibility of the commissioner of MMB. The work group that is proposed in the bill would operate outside of that framework, presumably to secure or to signal the intent to secure benefits for faculty that could place an unreasonable and undue hardship on the Minnesota state system to expand eligibility and provide benefits for faculty that already exceed the criteria of most any other employee in state service. Under current standards, the Minnesota State College faculty with full-time loads, which would be 32 credits per academic year, they currently have the lowest insurance eligibility thresholds in their contract in state service. Over the course of an academic year has been testified to, an instructor can teach as few as 12 credits, or roughly 37% of a full-time equivalent assignment, and be eligible for insurance in the Minnesota state system as a term and condition of the contract with the state college faculty. Currently, that basic eligibility criteria for temporary part-time appointments requires an appointment that totals 6 credits per semester over 2 consecutive academic year semesters to become initially eligible. We just agreed in our most recent collective bargaining agreement to new language that would allow a temporary part-time faculty member to meet that 6 credit threshold across the institutions in our system, as opposed to the previous language, which was limited to a single institution. This already expands access to the benefits. Faculty members holding temporary or part-time appointments who meet that basic eligibility criteria under the agreement, who are assigned to at least 6 credits but less than 12, also receive a partial employer contribution to the total cost or premium of those benefits. As MMB and CGIP is the principal state agency that would bargain those benefits, and they are excluded from the work group as written, at a minimum, I think it is critically important that MMB is a part of any work group that this committee would propose to commission. MMB and CGIP regularly and consistently engage in good faith negotiations over the terms and conditions of health insurance benefits for state employees. So with that, I yield for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Are there members of the public who wish to testify? Thank you. If you could introduce yourself for the record, and you can go ahead.
Yes. Chair members and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Carl Newman, and I'm a faculty member within the Minnesota state system, speaking in support of House File 4368. Public higher education has undergone a significant structural shift in recent years, with institutions increasingly relying on contingent faculty to deliver instruction. These faculty play an essential role in maintaining course availability and student access across the system. At the same time, the structure of contingent appointments often creates variability in workloads, compensation, and access to benefits, including health insurance. Because appointments are frequently made on a term-to-term basis and may vary in course load, eligibility for employer-sponsored health coverage can be inconsistent or difficult to maintain across academic terms. House Filing 4368 takes a measured and appropriate step by establishing a work group to examine these challenges more closely. This approach recognizes both the complexity of the issues and the need for a data-informed, system-level response. A work group allows stakeholders to evaluate current eligibility structures, identify gaps, and explore options that promote continuity and stability while remaining responsive to institutional needs. As contingent faculty continue to serve as a core part of instructional delivery, it is important that benefit structures evolve in a way that reflects that role. House Filing 4368 provides a thoughtful framework to begin that process. Thank you for the consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Newman. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify on House File 4368? Seeing no one, we will move to member discussion. Members, any discussion or questions? Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for presenting the bill before us, Representative Hansen. I thought I read somewhere, you're an adjunct professor, correct?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Allen. In my comments on House File 1751, if you go back and watch those, I did go into that more. I wanted to spare the committee repeating myself here, but I don't. This doesn't affect me because I have insurance through this place, and I teach the model legislature course here at Metro State as Representative Jean Pawlowski's protege.
Representative Allen.
I appreciate that, and thank you for doing what you can to help with teaching and whatnot. I was just kind of wondering, how long ago was the last negotiations for your contract?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. I just sent the form to sign up myself like a week ago, so I don't know. So I will have to defer to the other testifiers here to talk more about that.
Mr. Davis.
Chair Coulter, Representative Allen, the collective bargaining agreement was negotiated and ratified with MSCF, and our board took action on that in, I believe, the March meeting of our Board of Trustees. So it has been in effect since March and been implemented here just recently in the past few weeks.
Representative Allen.
Thank you for that, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I come from a union family. Electrical union works a little differently, but it's still being in negotiations and bargaining is kind of a big thing. I was just kind of wondering, why is a work group needed here instead of allowing, like, Minnesota State to study the adjunct eligibility through the existing labor and and budgeting and its benefits processes?
Can I speak to that?
Yes.
Representative Allen, they're still making the light bulbs go on. Go ahead.
So I'm lucky enough to be on the bargaining team for MSCF, so I'm the only contingent faculty, I believe, but there are people who have been contingent faculty. And the bargaining process is where you don't necessarily get a chance to have, you know, open conversations with the employer as much as you would like to. And I don't get, as a contingent faculty, as much opportunity to get input from my contingent faculty in the heat of the bargaining. I like to think, I made a comparison once of it being like cooking. You know, you could do a survey on a recipe, but when you're in the heat of the kitchen, that's not going to help you that much when things go wrong. And so a work group would be a really nice chance to have, you know, representatives from the different bargaining units and the employer and, you know, whoever else is suggested to be part of this work group together to have actual conversation and not such a structured bargaining tight pass proposal, go to your caucus, respond to proposal, situation, function, structure. It's more of a conversation, to summarize in one sentence.
Representative Allen?
Yep. No, I appreciate the answer. I guess that what I was just trying to understand is, you know, it's I have a hard time going through or getting into the idea that we have to have another formal study on something like this. We already probably have the ability to be able to do this through Minnesota State, I'm assuming. And so it's, you know, if there's a way to be able to push that along and hopefully get that accomplished, that'd be great. But thank you.
Representative Hansen, Ms. Erickson.
Sorry. Yes. And I appreciate that we had that study. I was actually able to speak at that study, too. And again, I guess I would say that that was a relatively formal process, and contingent faculty also had more of a limited input than I would hope we would have in this work group setting. And so I'm hoping for more problem solving. I think that the bill looks at obstacles that are in the way of solution. I don't know that it's quite the same as a study necessarily, and I would hope for more interaction with contingent faculty and the obstacles that they actually experience, because there are things that happen too. For instance, some contingent faculty, once they hit the 12 credit threshold, are actually opted into insurance when they don't need insurance. Like, they're on their partner's insurance, but then they're opted into MnState insurance, and then they're kicked off their partner's insurance, and they're like, that's not the insurance that I want. And then it takes a while for them to get off of the insurance, and it causes enormous problems for the family. And that's probably something that we'd like to resolve in a setting that doesn't happen as, it's a little bit more rigid in both a study and in the bargaining process.
Representative Hansen, do you have something to add? Or?
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to add, I could just keep bringing the same bill before you every time and tell you over and over it's $89 million, right, for us to do that. Or I think we could have this working group come together and maybe find a more feasible solution. Maybe there is some way to bring that cost down that we're not seeing through a fiscal note here, something like that. But I heard all of you when we talked about it last time that it was yes, we care about it. Yes, it's concerning, but also very, very big price tag on that. So trying to find some kind of a middle ground here. And I think that would give us a chance to look at the report and maybe have a conversation as a team here and decide which parts of it we maybe want to expand upon or let the light bulbs in our heads go off a little bit as policymakers.
Thank you. Members, any further discussion? All right. I am not seeing anything. Representative Hansen, any final thoughts?
Thank you, Chair. I just appreciate continuing this conversation. As we go into, you know, the future, there is a national conversation happening about adjunct versus tenure, and I think this committee will keep having that conversation as those reports develop. I referenced one in my comments today, but I do think it's something we should definitely watch and pay attention to and know that these folks are providing critical instruction at our universities, and we appreciate them.
Thank you very much, Representative Hansen. With that, House File 4368 is laid over. And just turned off my thing. I don't know why. Everybody can just stay up there because we're going to move right to House File 4889. Representative Hansen, take it away.
Thank you, Chair. House File 4889 is really just a starting point for a conversation, and I want that to be very, very clear at the outset. I am open to changing things in this, but we really wanted to just make sure that there was some conversation in this committee. This bill's jurisdiction is actually in labor, but given the time of the year and that this affects our university adjunct professors, I just wanted to pair it up here and have an informational hearing here just so you knew what was happening. In addition to that, I really don't have any intention of passing this bill as it is written right now and as introduced, and I want that to be really, really open and honest about that. We are aware that we're past deadlines and all of those things. That's why this is an informational hearing, and so I would appreciate keeping that in mind as we discuss it. So this bill is going to impact our higher education committee because it affects our instructors. I'm starting here because it impacts our educators, and they're really important to us. Reasonable assurance is not something that's as clear-cut for adjunct faculty as it might be in some other places. But don't worry, this bill is just a starting point. We're just going to get going on this. It is going to clarify that a written offer or financial guarantee of 50% pay if the employment falls through. Again, I know that number can make people shocked, but just please understand we're just talking about this for now. But I would really want to leave this to my testifier to tell you more. I think storytelling actually elaborates why this is an important conversation for us to have in the legislature, or at least to be familiar with. So I'll turn it over to my testifier. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Ms. Erickson, if you could reintroduce yourself for the record, and then you can go ahead.
Okay. So my name is Faith Erickson, and I teach English again at St. Cloud State University and St. Cloud Technical and Community College, and I thank you again for having this conversation. And I actually don't have quite as many stories because this is a conversation that contingent faculty are relatively loath and perhaps embarrassed to talk about, but I do have a few. And I just wanted to point out more of a concept and some stories. As I mentioned before, contingent faculty are treated in essence like full-time faculty in the services that they provide. Indifferently in different bargaining units, but still, they offer stability in times of instability. They serve on committees. They provide student support and often more of it because they are highly focused on teaching. They are under constant pressure to prove their worth. They have no guarantee of returning. A dean could just not hire them for any reason at all. They have no protection. And again, they are returning year after year for 20, 15 years. That is commitment, that is full-time work. And some are teaching 5-6 classes a semester. Under the MSCF contract, adjunct employees are temporary and under the IFO contract too, adjunct and contingent are temporary and can be canceled at any time prior to the start of term. That is their role. employment ends with the appointment period, and only full-time faculty, tenured faculty, have the expectation of continued work. That means when a semester ends, employment ends, any future work is uncertain and revocable. Contingent faculty regularly have classes removed, even full classes, like I said, sometimes days before the semester begins. I just gave you that story about the father who had his classes removed days before, had his insurance taken away, had his premium go up. But at the same time, Minnesota State has begun to argue that the general promise of work in fall is enough to deny unemployment benefits, even when those promises are not fulfilled. But by definition, again, contingent faculty are temporary and should not be expected to return. Yet they are used year after year to provide core instruction and support. They cannot have it both ways. They cannot have them temporary, not expected to return year after year, and yet not give them the support they need in insurance and unemployment support. The impact of this is significant. Contingent faculty are not paid over the summer. It is not a break. They go months without income, relying on uncertain course assignments that may come in late or not at all. When promised classes don't materialize, the consequences are real. One contingent faculty member and her sister were forced to sell their family farm after inheriting it because the income they were counting on did not come through. Classes canceled. And that seems extreme, but I want to explain it to you. Others fall behind on bills, take on debt, or lose basic services. I know many faculty who have had their phones shut off or have had to ask their parents for help with rent, despite teaching multiple courses during the academic year. They promise their creditors that they will pay back over the summer, but then they cannot, and they get late fees and bad debt. And it takes years to return, years to repair. And when they don't get their pay on time, sometimes they are not paid from May until October or later. And so when they think that they are promised pay and they push back their debt, that has a ginormous income. And when the classes that they are promised do not come through, that has a huge impact. We know that the system has the ability to provide more stability, whether through more consistent access to health insurance or by not blocking access to unemployment insurance. They cannot treat contingent faculty as temporary when it comes to the benefit, while simultaneously relying on them as ongoing labor. This bill, again, though not perfect, addresses that imbalance, or at the very least, provides some financial protection when promised work does not materialize. Thank you for your time, and I welcome your questions.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson. We will move next to Mr. Newman, who I think is sitting behind there. Thank you. If you could also reintroduce yourself, and then you can.
All right. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity again to testify. My name is Carl Newman, and I'm a faculty member within the Minnesota State System. Speaking on House File 4889. Within public higher education, many contingent faculty are employed on a term-to-term basis. Course assignments are often dependent on enrollment, departmental needs, and funding, and they're frequently not finalized until shortly before the semester begins. In some cases, courses that are offered are later reduced or canceled. Despite this, current interpretations of reasonable assurance can treat informal or conditional indications of future teaching as if they constitute guaranteed employment. In practice, this creates a gap between how employment is defined in statute and how it actually functions. Faculty may not have a confirmed course load, a finalized contract, or a reliable income between academic terms, yet may still be deemed ineligible for unemployment benefits. The issue is not whether faculty may return to teach. Many do. The issue is whether there is a binding, enforceable commitment at the time benefits are denied. In many cases, there is not. House filing 4889 helps bring clarity to this distinction by ensuring that reasonable assurance reflects actual employment conditions rather than contingent possibilities. Aligning statutory interpretation with operational reality supports both fairness for workers and consistency in policy application. Thank you for consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Newman and Mr. Davis. If you could likewise reintroduce yourself for the record, and then you can proceed.
Chair Coulter, my name is Eric Davis. I'm the Vice Chancellor for Human Resources at the Minnesota State College and University System. Thank you for hearing my testimony today. Amending the statute's current definition of what constitutes reasonable assurance and limiting that solely to the faculty of the public higher education system at Minnesota State for instructional or research capacity faculty in an institution of higher ed, as proposed, would profoundly and foundationally change the nature of contingent employment at Minnesota State. Contingent faculty, as has been testified to, are primarily made up of non-tenure track, adjunct, temporary part-time instructors. They are used across our system for specialized or temporary or emergency staffing needs, typically. Sabbatical replacements is one example, are addressing sudden enrollment surges, which are fairly typical at our colleges. The appointments typically terminate at the end of the stated period and, as has been testified to, carries no implication of future employment. Also, as has been testified to, many of our contingent faculty do return to us from semester to semester. They have a great performance record, and we do rely on them to continue to teach for us year after year. And as has been testified to, some of our contingent faculty members have taught for us for years in that capacity. As our instructors or as our institutions are unlikely to be able to provide the reasonable assurance as proposed in this definition for our contingent faculty, which is capped at Minnesota State at 30%. So we have language in our collective bargaining agreement that prevents the Minnesota State College and University system from having greater than 30% of our faculty in contingent appointments. The amendment would predictably place an undue hardship on the Minnesota State system. To my knowledge, we have not done a fiscal note, nor has the committee asked for one, but I suspect that it would increase our cost and put an undue burden on the college and university system, which is struggling as it is. So with that, I yield for questions. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify on House File 4889? Not seeing anyone come forward, we will turn to member discussions. I think before we open it up, I think I just want to sort of start by saying I think what we're hearing from this bill and the previous bill is I think there are some pretty important sort of structural issues that we're seeing with the increase in usage and tenure, at the risk of using a loaded term, of contingent faculty. And I think I know Minnesota is not unique in that, and I think we're just kind of grappling with what that looks like as a pretty significant shift within higher education. So, Representative Cleborn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I'm thinking about this. As our higher education institutions, and I'm not just talking about Minnesota State, but all higher education institutions, have shifted from the certain cost of full-time, permanent, tenured faculty to using adjunct, and now I always grew up with the word adjunct, but now the word contingent. I mean, to me, the word contingent is really problematic, right? Whenever I look at legislation, I think about who pays, who benefits, right? And I'm hearing that the contingent faculty are really paying a tremendous cost because we are not funding our institutions in a way that can truly support full-time, permanent, tenured faculty. And since I serve on state government, I'm thinking about classification of employees, right? So whether we're talking admin or MMB or now the higher education institutions, my question is, is there really a misclassification of employee occurring, right? So if you have a just-in-time employment strategy, and that is a cost-shifting burden from the institution to the employee, then you're using just-in-time to fill your needs without thinking about the need of the employee. But when I'm hearing that there are temporary employees who have been filling positions for 20 or 28 or 40 years, that is a permanent part-time employee as opposed to a just-in-time, than a temporary contingent, really temporary employee. If the intent is that that employee will return year after year after year, semester after semester after semester, then that really is a permanent part-time employee who should have different benefit structure than the last-minute emergency need to go out and fill a temporary position. So that causes me some great pause because the employees are paying a tremendous cost for that. And it may benefit the state, I'm not saying that, but somebody's paying the cost. And we need to look at that because that burden, that cost, has more than financial repercussions. I'm hearing the stress, I'm hearing the health, I'm hearing the emotional well-being of entire families, right? So we need to really consider what that is and how we define that in statute. It may be that we need to think about when does an adjunct professor become permanent part-time as opposed to true contingent. And that would come at a cost to the state where the cost should be borne, I think, for a public institution. So I would welcome your comments, Mr. Davis. I know this is the way business is conducted, but the question is this the right way for business to be conducted?
Mr. Davis?
Chair Coulter, Representative Cleborn, thank you for your questions and your comments. A couple of points I'd like to clarify for the committee. First of all, under the terms and conditions of the collective bargaining agreement with the Minnesota State College faculty, we have a cap on the number of credits basically that are taught by contingent faculty. That cap is 30%. So 70% of the faculty at the Minnesota State Colleges are in unlimited appointment types by contract. Okay. That makes Minnesota very different than most every other state in the union. Most of the, as has been testified to nationally, the use of contingent faculty across the United States is much higher, considerably higher. And it does raise the cost of instruction at Minnesota, but the theory holds that you would also get better instruction with the more career instructors, right? So that cap is somewhat unique here to Minnesota. No such cap exists in our public universities. However, the terms of their collective bargaining agreement do specify when a university in our public system is authorized to use an adjunct faculty, and it sets such conditions as I testified to today, like filling behind someone who was on a sabbatical or some kind of enrollment surge or some sort of experimental or specialized employment condition. An exception is made for Metropolitan State University. There is language in statute as well as reflected in our collective bargaining agreement with the interfaculty organization that permits the Metropolitan State to hire community faculty, which are paid on the adjunct rate. And the theory or philosophy behind that is that the community faculty member is an expert here in the metropolitan area, usually full-time employed in some other capacity, who teaches one or two classes for the university and gives our students access to people who are acting or working professionals in their field of study. And so that's the philosophy behind that. And that is not an uncommon use of contingent faculty in our communities throughout Minnesota. It allows us to access people who are not interested necessarily in a career as an educator or an instructor in our system, but are interested in meeting our augmentation or augmenting us when the needs demand it. Lastly, I would just say that there is also language in our collective bargaining agreement with the Minnesota State College faculty that specify the terms and conditions of when a contingent faculty member is converted by default to an unlimited appointment type. It is, I think, I don't have the contract in front of me, but I believe it's 5 consecutive years. So if you have that semester, you have that teaching threshold for those consecutive semesters, you will be converted to an unlimited part-time or unlimited full-time instructor under the terms and conditions of that agreement. There are variances in that, as I'm sure my colleagues can testify to, where the credit load shifts and that changes their eligibility for that conversion. Mm-hmm. However, in to comply with the terms of the collective bargaining agreement, we routinely convert contingent faculty appointments to unlimited appointment types out of when we recognize that this is happening year over year.
Could I respond Ms. to that, Erickson. Please? There is a cap at the 2 year. It's, I believe it's 30-70 at the state level, 40-60 at the college level. It goes over that sometimes where there has to be rectification for that. And as I mentioned before, it's not a credit. So contingent faculty can teach as many credits as they want. It's just the amount of contingent faculty in the system. So we have contingent faculty sometimes teaching 18 credits per semester. It's not that they are teaching 30% of a full-time credit load. So that's a difference. I just wanted to make sure that that was clear. It's the amount of contingent faculty in the system. And they are still in the system for 20 plus years. My statistics still stand, teaching the full-time amount of credits for 20 some years. At I believe it's 40-60% at the college level, full-time to part-time, and 30-70% at the state level. And again, that often, not often, I wouldn't say often, but it goes over that and has to be rectified. Also, the conversion, it's 6 years, I believe, and it does not happen very frequently. It happens not frequently, and it's heartbreaking. It's like a game. It's a game where people will get up to the very last semester, and then they will be dropped a class and have to start from scratch. They don't have to start from the year. They start from year one again. And so to use that as a semblance of security is honestly insulting.
Representative Cleburne, did you have anything more?
Yeah, I would just like to ask Mr. Davis, does it go back to year one if they lose a semester?
Mr. Davis.
Chair Coulter, Representative Cleburne, it does. So if there's a change in the workload of the assignment, that would have made you eligible for a conversion to an unlimited appointment type, but that changes for some reason at the college, the person goes back. They have to have it as consecutive terms or consecutive semesters by the terms of the collective bargaining agreement.
Representative Cleburne.
Is there any exception for health, wellness, anything?
Mr. Davis.
Chair Coulter, Representative Cleburne, the terms and conditions of the collective bargaining agreement do not specify any special conditions such as absence for illness or some other reason.
All right. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cleburne. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm turning into a frequent flyer on this committee. As I'm looking through the bill, I'm looking at lines 2.26 through 2.31, and I was, as I'm kind of looking through it, my fear is by requiring a written non-contingent offer or a contract with a 50% pay guarantee, are we kind of setting a standard that many colleges just simply can't meet, especially when we look at classes and as students are getting enrolled and the course loads depend so much in these colleges based on enrollment and late budgetary decisions. Can someone kind of speak to that?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative. We're actually setting no such standard because this is an informational hearing and this bill is a starting point. So I want to be really clear about that. And like, my intent is not to just charge forward with something. My intent is to have a team conversation with folks who care about higher education and make these decisions together. We all know if I hop over to the Labor Committee, they're not going to love our system as much as we do. That's why I wanted to start here. I think we all really, really are invested in this. We do. Many of us have served on this committee for many sessions in a row. And so that passion is what I'm tapping into by having this bill here today. And then once we are on the same page and we decide what looks best, then I think it would be more appropriate to go to labor. And then we can all kind of advocate for our institutions in the way that looks best. So we are setting no standard right now. We are just talking.
Representative Allen.
And that kind of gets to my question as well, is that it wouldn't a bill like this been better to start over on labor, since it is really getting into the labor component a lot more than anything else?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. I like you better. That's why I'm here. Really. It's after deadline. You know, I know that, I recognize that. And this conversation's been happening for a while. So it got drafted. We had, you know, we wanted to have the conversation about adjuncts, especially given what the national conversation is looking like as we start to see more discussions about the ratio of tenure to adjunct. I did email all the members while we were up here a link to the article I referenced about adjuncts in higher education. So it's a pretty quick read, but there's some interesting charts in there and some interesting information that I hope can inform all of us as we continue the conversation.
Representative Allen, anything further? I will say it's kind of academic, since this is our last our second to last hearing. The bill is technically being laid over. This is not an informational hearing, but I guess the effect is more or less the same.
Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, and my intent is not to include this in anything this year. While we are indeed laying it over, that is, as the author, that is my wish, is that we just continue the conversation. So I just want to be clear about that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Chair Wolgamott. Yes.
Thanks. I just wanted to add on to that and echo Representative Hansen said, and just to make clear, on top of everything she said, I wanted to hear this bill with the hearing today in committee for all the reasons Rep. Hansen mentioned, as well as I just again want to highlight how proud I am of my constituent who has been the champion on this. And it's my honor in my last hearing controlling a gavel to be able to give you a hearing on this. And I want to thank you for your continued championship and advocacy for this really, really crucial issue. So kudos to you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Chair Wilmot. Chair Robbins.
Thank you, Chair Coulter, and thank you to Representative Hansen and your guests for bringing this conversation. I generally think the use of adjunct faculty, if it's described as you originally described it, to fill in when people want part-time work, when they're a subject matter expert, when I think it works really well. I have also been an adjunct faculty member at a different point in my life, and it was very rewarding, but I knew I didn't want to teach full time. and it was just a great opportunity to do at that point in my life. But I have to say the discussion that Chair Cleaforn outlined about the inability to convert to full time or the barriers to that, it's not really about whether they, in my view, it's not about this bill. It's about this discussion about how hard it is to convert to full time. So I just wanted to ask the gentleman, so if you have someone who has, you know, a 12 credit course load, under what circumstance would you convert them to 11.99? Like, how does that happen and who makes that decision?
Mr. Davis.
Chair Coulter, Representative Robbins, I'm not aware that today was the first time I had heard of an adjunct faculty appointment that was 0.01 less than the threshold of eligibility for insurance. I'm not sure what would that look like. Those decisions are made on the campus by academic leaders. Typically, the dean of a particular college or program is responsible for balancing out that workload. And that would go through a chain of command that would include the vice president of academic and student affairs and ultimately the president, although presidents aren't typically involved in workload assignments. So, but I'm not aware of the scenario that was described today.
Thank you. And thank you, Chair Coulter. And a second question I have is there data on the number of adjunct faculty who have served 20 years or 10 years or whatever, and then have had to reset the clock so that they haven't been converted? So I'd like to understand the data, how many people this is affecting, how long this has been going on, how many people get right up to the threshold of converting and then are rotated back to year one. So I don't know how we find that data or who provides it to us, but that's incredibly important to understand what's going on here. And if we can have it by campus, that would be even more important. So I'm just making a data request to whoever can provide that.
I didn't hear a question in there.
No.
I don't know if anybody has
a response. I don't know if it's you or whoever, Bernie, whoever, however we can get that data. And I think making that available to the entire committee, not just me, would be helpful. Thank you. That's all I have.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Cleaver, is it to this point?
Yeah, and this is right to what Representative Robbins is talking about. And I think because there's no exception for health or any of the natural things that would happen in life, it would be very interesting to know the gender balance for that, because I think women would be disproportionately impacted if they're in their childbearing years.
Representative Cleaver. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative Cleaver, and you make a good point. In the report that I sent you, there is some information about gender disparities and racial disparities of who is considered adjunct faculty nationally. It's not specific to Minnesota. I want to be clear about that. And so that does lean into the fact that, you know, culturally as a country, we do have some disparities in that. But I don't know the numbers from Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Representative Rarick, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Hansen, I'm listening, both bills, and I appreciate Chair Robbins pointing out, let's find out what the scope is, because this sounds really bad. Mm-hmm. I'm looking right at our MinState folks here. This sounds really, really bad. So I want to know what the scope is. So I appreciate the individual stories and the anecdotes. Those are very powerful. Now I want to know how many. Mm-hmm. Which campuses? Who made those decisions? So I'll be back on this committee next biennium, Lord willing, that we're, you know, nothing crazy happens in the election or whatever, but I'll be able to continue this forward. So in that light, I've also served probably, I don't know, 6 or 8 years or something as a member on the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council. Carried their bills many years. I was just doing a quick search. I'm like, oh my gosh, my name is like over and over around these bills that I've carried. I do stuff and I forget. So that's a really important place to go with this particular bill. And I'm wondering, Representative Hansen, have you had a conversation at the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council? What's your plan going forward? And I realize that we're not labor. I did my stint on labor. I like it better here too.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. I think my plan is to just work as a team and decide what we as a higher education team want to do. I mean, we have a huge budget that we oversee. This is a pretty, between the two bills could potentially be pretty costly, and we have some other priorities. So I would like to move as a team on this so that we can really stand with our instructors and our systems to kind of sit in the gap, have the conversation, knowing that folks are well-intentioned, and this is maybe a hangover of cultural norms that have just kind of happened and maybe snowballed a little bit, and how can we come back together? So that's my goal. I was glad you brought that up, though. I was kind of hoping somebody who served on that committee or the commission would bring that up, because I have not. And so it would be great to have some folks kind of share in the interest in finding a solution here, because I don't think these two bills are going to solve it entirely. And so I'm also looking forward to hearing more reports and numbers and kind of seeing where we can kind of, what does the target look like and what are we aiming for? But I think it would take all of us to be on the same page about that before. And so I don't want this to become a partisan, discussion back and forth. I would really like to make sure we see our institutions, as we always have, as really valuable assets to the entire state of Minnesota.
Representative Rank, anything?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciate that. The Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council can be very helpful even if you just, you know, got on their agenda and talked about this, and yes, I'm sure this is going to be expensive and you haven't run the numbers exactly because we don't have a fiscal note in front of us, but that's a really good place to start sooner than later because they are full of great advisors, and it does impact the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund, which, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. you want to kick that hornet's nest, right? You want to kind of go in there more gently.
Yeah. yeah. So,
thank you, Representative Hansen. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Barrett. Representative Liebling. Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill forward, particularly about the UI. I also served in the UI Advisory Council. I don't think it's functioning anymore. I think we haven't received any recommendation for many years, and I think former commissioner kind of suspended it, and I haven't had any information coming. So this has been the way that we've been making changes under the unemployment insurance process, and we have had this discussion not once but a couple of times in terms of how do we define the reasonable assurance, and maybe we continue to discuss and hopefully we can find a pathway. So thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Knorr. We are running short on time. I'm not seeing anybody else jump up. So Representative Hansen, if you want to close things out.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Committee, for a good discussion. This is exactly what I thought we would want to have as just a conversation about this. So thank you for understanding that the language is in flux. I appreciate that. I'm admittedly, as many of you know, out of my depths when we kind of get into these sorts of issues, and so thank you for letting me start in a familiar place with a familiar team and to have this conversation about what's important, and I will I have lots of notes here that I've taken forward, and I'll probably talk to you all offline. Thank you again.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. With that, House File 4889 is laid over. Members, that concludes our agenda. We will be back for our probably final hearing on Thursday, and I think you're going to want to watch. Have a good evening, and we are adjourned.